can't give you a definitive answer, because I think that what lies at the heart of that connection is very personal and individual. And yet what I will say is that regardless of the relationship that we have with the individual relationship we have with an animal, what we sense is a depth of connectedness with them that we don't share commonly with every being out there, every person out there. We walk around in our daily lives and oftentimes feel disconnected from others in our world, from the world around us in all reality. And I believe what underlies that relationship is a sense of feeling a depth of understanding and a depth of connection that we long for in our daily lives. And I don't think this is something that's unique to us in America or even to humans in modern times. All the evidence I've seen is that from our onset as a species, as human beings, we have held a fascination and a sense of wonderment and connection towards the other beings that we share the planet with. And it's that ultimately, I think, that underlies the relationship that we end up developing and forging with the animals that come into our lives.
And in fact, many humans say that if they were next to alone in the world, they'd rather spend the remainder of their lives with a pet rather than a partner.
Yes, that's actually a true statistic that the majority of people surveyed actually said that if they were to spend the rest of their days lost on a desert island with only one individual, more people would choose a dog or a cat than another human being, even one that's close to us. I think that's very telling because it says something about the depth of relationship that we share with these other beings in our lives.
Now, you've been a personal witness to this human-animal relationship and interaction in your practice through the years. Dr. Virgo, is there one or are there several that stand out the most to you?
Wow, there have been so many relationships that I've seen and been privileged to share some level of intimacy with. And I think early on in my experience, it was all with companion animals, dogs and cats and birds and pets. In recent years, past 8-10 years, I've been doing mostly, and certainly in very recent years, exclusively zoo work. And what comes to mind are some of the keepers that I work with on a regular, daily, or weekly basis, and the animals left in their care. I think it's interesting. Working in the zoo world, because it's not something that I think intuitively people would say, oh, the people that work day to day with these animals are just as connected with them as I am to my dog or cat at home. And yet, if you stop and think about it for a minute, these people are not living particularly high paid or working in high paid jobs, living glamorous lives. These people are serving an important job in caring for several animals, sometimes quite a few animals, in a zoo setting, and their day-to-day job is totally to care for and attend to the needs of those individual animals, these keepers that work at the zoos. So I think of, when you ask me that question, I think of the faces and the stories behind some of the keepers I've worked with who have dedicated their day-to-day life to trying to improve the quality of the animals' lives and their care. I tell in my book about an ocelot named Yaku that lived with his companion Tika. And Yaku was a particularly tough, challenging patient for me in that he spent a good portion of his life for well over a year hiding from the front and most of the areas of his habitat, which was, by all standards, by anyone's standards, a very nice habitat for a cat in a zoo setting. And I struggled day in, week after week, month after month, trying to figure out how to care for Yaku so that he could enjoy the lush, rich, large world he had to live in, and that Tika, his companion, was certainly enjoying. Yet something was keeping Yaku reclusively hiding in the back of his habitat for much of his life, for over a year, well over a year. And Sarah, his keeper, was particularly one of those people I'm talking about. I could see the level of compassion and concern for his welfare and his well-being, and the pain that it caused her to try everything she possibly knew to help him to overcome his apprehensiveness about going and exploring his world. And never, despite all of our efforts and struggles to try to help him in his resistance to responding, never giving up, never being willing to give up, just being steadfastly committed to whatever it takes to improve Yaku's life. Now, I don't think Sarah by any means is unique, and I don't think that's that level of commitment is unique to the keepers I work with. When I did work with companion animals in behavioral practice, I witnessed it, that commitment and longing to improve the quality of each animal's life day to day, routinely in my practice. And again, it speaks a lot to the depth of connection that we sense, that we often don't really, that we even as humans have trouble putting into words, because it's something that is very intimate and personal that we share with these other beings.
And was Yaku eventually able to acclimate to his surroundings?
People really love to know what happened with Yaku, and what I would tell you is that Yaku enjoys his world about, in honesty, about 75%, maybe 80% of his days. So he loves the world around him and enjoys it with Tika most days, 4 out of 5 days roughly. But then there's 1 out of 5 days where he seems to slip back into his old inhibition, and what it's about is still the biggest challenge that I face in trying to help him, in that he's never been able to tell us, of course, in human terms, what it is that's bothering him. It's been one of the most biggest challenges and mysteries in terms of my day-to-day work with a patient. So he's 75, 80% better, which, if you think about it, for people with problems relating to fear or anxiety, behavioral struggles they're going through, how often are we able to say, oh, we just, over the course of 6 months or a year, waved a wand, and now this person's 100% better and living a perfectly happy, well-adjusted life. Sometimes, especially with behavioral issues, it takes time and care and patience, and it's part of what I particularly love about behavioral medicine, because it does require that sustained level of commitment to really help care.
As you consult with a number of zoos on behavioral and management issues, overall, what are they doing right, and where's there room for improvement?
Well, zoos have evolved tremendously over the past 20, 30 years. Even in terms of if you look at what they were originally, how they originally came to be, 100, 200 years ago, pretty much they evolved from private menageries in China with the emperors, in Europe with the rulers, kings, queens, and so forth. And when they first became open to the public, it was mainly to provide the public with some type of entertainment, allowing them to see animals up close and in person. Zoos have evolved tremendously since then, so they've shifted from an entertainment and even exhibit person perspective to realizing realizing a very different mission, which is conservation, and exhibits are now considered habitats. Keeping an animal is now considered more caretaking. This has all evolved for two reasons. One, out of greater awareness as science has progressed through the years, and also out of greater public sensitivity to the needs of animals. It's also evolved, quite frankly, out of our deteriorating condition of our outer world. The sad reality is that we are in the midst of a unprecedented mass extinction event in modern ages, where literally hundreds of species are no longer existing on this planet that were existing 100 years ago, and we are just in the midst of this. This is not something that's tapering down, and the reality is that the wild animals out there in the world that we think live in these pristine environments are actually suffering tremendous loss of quality of life, loss of habitat, and loss of number of their species because of climate change, because of encroachment upon their terrain by human beings, and as a result of poaching, hunting, and pollution. And the reality is that zoos now are becoming more and more life rafts, so to speak, for many of these species, where they would not survive out there in the wild or continue to even exist out there in the wild unless zoos were providing a resource for the gene pool of those species and investing in research and conservation efforts. So the zoos out there that I work with day to day have evolved from basically a circus entertainment type of mentality to a very committed conservation, education, quality of life perspective in terms of saving and preserving the other species on this planet.
As far as the animal inhabitants of zoos, how is their perception of humans, how is it different than animals in the wild? I'm assuming because they're around people, there's got to be some differences in perception.
Well, I don't know that the animals in zoos have a difference in perception. They still are wild species. Most of the animals, by far and large, most of the animals in zoos are captive bred or captive born, and that means they've gone through multiple generations of breeding between individuals in different zoos and trying to preserve their gene pools. But we're talking about wild creatures, wild beings, and So their instincts, their senses, their patterns of behavior, the way they express themselves, their innate behaviors are pretty much unchanged from those in the wild. They might not be expressed the same way because you have a giraffe living on 40 acres or 20 acres in a wild animal park instead of out there in the savanna. But the behaviors themselves, the giraffes then adapt to the world in which they live. So, and we do that as humans. We change our behaviors whether we're out in the country, live in the city, and so forth. But there's no doubt about it that the animals in zoos are exposed to different types of environments than animals in the wild. And probably one of the biggest differences, of course, would be that they're exposed to people. And, you know, an animal in the wild can retreat and escape or avoid human beings. And in a zoo setting, they're much less able to do so. In fact, that actually is one of the considered to be a much more progressive idea in zoo design nowadays, in that most habitats that are being newly constructed in zoos actually will provide animals some place that they can retreat from the prying eyes of visitors and the noise of people as they're walking by their habitats. But also it depends upon zoo design. There's other ways in which we can try to provide the animals a sense of privacy and control over their world. But the ways in which they perceive their world are, I think, no different as an individual than if they were in the wild. It's more what they're exposed to. So that actually is one of the things that I really, quite honestly, struggle with as I go to zoo. Part of my job is to watch the animals in the course of their daily life, to try to better understand them so I can improve their quality of life as best I can. And that involves looking at the world in which they're living in. And I watch people walking through zoos a lot of times and not really thinking about that they're walking basically next to these animals' homes. If we were to walk by each other's homes with the type of volume and enthusiasm and playing around as we walk by our neighbor's window or people walk by our window, we'd feel like there was no sense of privacy or quiet around our homes. And I think that's something we could really afford to do as human beings is in general be a lot more sensitive to the habitat in which these animals live.
We are visiting with Dr. Vint Verga, a veterinary medicine practitioner recognized the world over for his insights into our relationships with animals. Dr. Verga will be a featured speaker at the upcoming Animal Conference, March 30th and 31st, at the Skirvin Hotel in downtown Oklahoma City. Dr. Verga, when did you know that you wanted to work with animals?
Oh, well, I've been attracted to animals, I think, since I was a young boy. In fact, quite honestly, I feel more comfortable a lot of times around animals than I do around people. I was one of those kids that at family gatherings, at dinner parties and so forth, while all the adults and children are running around, I would tend to find the dog or cat and go off to a quiet corner and sit with them and find a lot more comfort and happiness than trying to deal with the nuances and subtleties and hidden communications that human beings share among each other. How that translated into becoming a veterinarian, I think it was just an evolution. I wasn't certain, although I considered being a vet, I think as early as around sixth grade, I think. I wasn't certain about it, quite honestly, until my freshman year of college, as I started to take college courses. Now, I suspected it because I went to UC Davis as an undergraduate. And so in high school, I thought, yeah, I probably want to go that direction. But there was the science part I really enjoyed. And for a while there, I remember thinking I really wanted to become a heart surgeon more than anything else. But I think that what ultimately guided me was this sense of feeling not most comfortable with animals than with people, but a sense that same sense of connectedness we were talking about before, in feeling that depth of compassion for them and wanting to advocate for them in terms of their well-being, their health, and trying. The more that drove me, the more I became curious and fascinated with trying to understand the world from their perspective, realizing that I'm different from them in trying to understand what it must be like and feel like to be a dog or a cat or a leopard or a zebra.
Well, as you mentioned, different animals, do you see similarities in some of the behavioral traits or problems? What commonalities are there among the species?
I think that even though our dogs and cats are domesticated, particularly with cats, I find it absolutely fascinating, and it's one of my pet areas of greatest interest. It is the similarities between and across different felid, different cat species. Remarkably, there are so many similarities between large cat and small cat species behaviors. Interestingly, the ways in which they express themselves, the ways in which they explore their world, the ways in which they spend their time in the course of the day are remarkably, very interestingly similar between a leopard, a family house cat, a sand cat or palace cat, a mountain lion, and a tiger. So I think that, interestingly enough, the correlations between our domestic dogs and cats' behaviors and those of their cousins out there in the wild are interestingly more similar than they are dissimilar. Now, there's definitely differences. There's certainly differences in behavior patterns between dogs and wolves. We've bred dogs to be a being that's very oriented towards humans, and the traits in which we've selected for in terms of this social canid, this ancestor to our modern domestic dogs, we were looking for traits that we wanted, particularly as humans, to try to refine and cultivate. So our dogs are remarkably very oriented towards us as humans, but they also have remarkable abilities to understand our human gestures, expressions, changes in intonation in voice. And those are all things that, because they're domesticated and we've literally controlled and selected for those traits, those are traits that are expressed very differently than they would be in a wolf, which or another wild canid, such as an African wild dog, which, while both those are very, very social beings, they're social in a very different way, in that they're very refined and cultivated and in tune with communication with their counterparts, other wolves or other African wild dogs, and not nearly as refined in terms of their ability to interpret human signals as would be a family dog.
What is an example in your experience of an extreme behavior that in an animal, and what was your basically your treatment path to overcome it?
Well, an example of an extreme behavior, the one that comes to mind would be an Irish wolfhound. His name was Doogie. And Doogie literally suffered from obsessive compulsive disorder. The way I met him is that his family had called me to come and see them at their home and meet Doogie. And what his problem was, as they told me about it, was that he was not spending time with the family as he used to. And instead of joining the family, we were just talking about the social orientation of dogs towards their humans. Doogie had shifted in his pattern of behavior towards spending most of his time from early morning to midday, and then from mid-afternoon to evening, to well into the evening, in the front rooms of the house, mainly the living room. When he wasn't in those rooms, he would seem to be oriented mainly to the front windows, whatever room he was in, whether he was in the kitchen or den or so forth. When the kids would want to go out and play with him in the yard, where he used to run around and play and chase and catch ball. By the time I had visited him, he wasn't really interested in playing with the kids. He basically wanted to just go back into the house so he could be in the living room. And what Doogie would do is basically watch not only through the windows for what they weren't certain what he was watching for, they didn't know, but he would also seem to chase imaginary insects around the house, things that they could never see. At first they thought maybe he had fleas or there were ants or bugs he was chasing, but they never could find anything. And what ended up happening over the course of my evaluating Doogie and watching videos of him and seeing him in person and up close live in his home is what I discovered was that he was actually chasing reflections from passing cars, baby strollers of people walking by the house. Inside the house, he would chase reflections off of keys or shiny objects, spoons at breakfast time if they caught the sunlight. And that was his basic job or preoccupation, was to patrol the house as far as the way it looked and watch for these imaginary insects or reflections and chase them. When a behavior occupies an animal's life to the degree that it interferes with their normal functioning, they'd rather not eat, they'd rather not play, they'd rather just focus on that particular activity, and it happens repetitively in a very predictable pattern, it's very likely that could be a compulsive behavior, and that's in fact what I had diagnosed with Doogie. I would say that that's probably one of the most extreme types of behavior I deal with any type of animal, is an obsessive compulsive disorder. OCD is an anxiety disorder. It's a behavioral issue that's seen across species from humans to wild animals in certain types of settings to family pets in certain types of settings. And why it occurs is because it is a manifestation of anxiety. An animal is experiencing, or a person is experiencing, anxiety to a degree in which that they start developing patterns of behavior to cope with that anxiety that are very predictable and routine and repetitive, and they become basically these compulsive behaviors become a strategy to deal with the constant anxiety that these animals experience. So with Doogie, what we focused on was decreasing his anxiety and giving him new behaviors in which to engage other than chasing reflections. and Doogie lived a Doogie lived a very happy, well-adjusted, normal life. In the end of it all, where he no longer was chasing reflections or shadows or anything else around the house, and was back to enjoying playing with the kids, eating, and not spending his day in the living room looking for lights bouncing off the wall.
And what are some of the things that would trigger this this anxiety, which would lead to this type of behavior?
Well, that's a good question. With Doogie, it started literally with the early morning cars actually shining lights on the walls, and some dogs seem to enjoy chasing just as part of their natural behavioral repertoire. But that chasing behavior is not obsessive behavior or compulsive behavior. And so there's got to be some degree of trauma, stress, or ongoing anxiety that's innate to the individual that ultimately predisposes them to develop OCD. Why do some animals find certain situations particularly anxiety producing or stressful and not others? That of course is the $50,000 question. Why do you or I develop certain types of fears or anxieties, and other people develop different ones? Anxieties and fears are not rational behaviors. But there's something that seems to be very individually associated with a predisposition. So probably there's some genetic component. Probably there's some degree of stress that ultimately precipitates or causes a behavioral condition to suddenly flare up and develop. And then the other probable component is that there's the individual personality. What makes that person or that animal unique from everybody else? And that we don't understand, of course. You know, why are two siblings that are almost genetically very, very similar still so remarkably dissimilar when it comes to how they respond and to the world around them? So that, of course, is the big black box of behavior within each of us.
And how does the aging process impact animals and their behavior?
How does the aging process impact animals? Well, I think that I'm assuming you mean as they become older, not a young animal maturing, right?
Right. You know, an older animal that's slowed down, that maybe isn't playing with the kids as much as they did when they were younger, wants to sleep more, et cetera. I mean, are there behavioral changes that you see as animals enter the final stages of their lives?
Sure. I think that as animals become older, certainly they adjust to their bodies, and they I think in general it behooves us, of course, to listen to the aches and pains of our bodies, the metabolism of our bodies, and as animals' bodies slow down, I think that in general they tend to respond appropriately and adjust their activities and adjust their daily preoccupations. So where a dog would love to chase and play ball, as much as they love to chase and play ball as an older dog, they may become a lot more clever in terms of how they go about participating in ball chasing. I think of a dog that I know at a farm I visit a couple of times a year. Her name's Chloe, and she's at a farm in New Hampshire called East Hill Farm. And I've watched Chloe through the years. She's one of my, she's not a patient. She's just been a friend through the years. And Chloe always has a ball by her side. I rarely can even think of times when she doesn't have a ball by her side. And as much as she used to love to catch balls, her favorite thing to do was to, this may sound a bit odd, but she used to like to sit on the stairs and have people toss a ball to her, and she would have one ball in her mouth, and she would bunt the ball that you tossed to her with the ball in her mouth. So it almost looks a little bit like she's playing catch or playing softball. And she could do that for hours at a time, quite frankly.
Wow.
And nowadays, Chloe has adjusted to that by being a lot more selective. You know, if she has to reach out very far to bounce that ball, if she has to move her body very far to bounce that ball, she doesn't do it. So basically what I watch her, she entered limiting her movements because she's listening to her body. She also gets the people around her to play with her a lot more mindfully and a lot more focused on trying to get the ball exactly where Chloe needs it so that she can still have fun and pleasure in one of her favorite activities. Dogs and cats and other animals also, as they get older, sometimes experience a certain amount of slowing down of the brain. And brain function, and we think of that in humans as being, you know, senility, and we do see a certain amount of senility in older animals as they get older. Sometimes we see more serious conditions, such as similar, but not completely, but somewhat like Alzheimer's disease, where we actually see dementias and loss of memory in older animals, but pretty much the most common things I see in animals as they age are that they just learn to adjust and listen to their bodies, much like you and I do.
You know, you've devoted your professional life to this connection between humans and animals, Dr. Verga, and I'm just wondering from your perspective, when you hear these stories of animal abuse and neglect, what goes through your mind, and kind of what can we do as a society to promote a more nurturing attitude to among all creatures, great and small?
Well, of course, any time that I hear of these stories of animal neglect and abuse, I find them just as troubling as I'm sure you and your listeners do. And it troubles me of obviously because of the suffering or the pain that the animal has had to go through, but it also troubles me because of the ways in which the person or people have caused that pain upon animals. I do not believe that is inherently a human trait to be abusive or neglectful towards other beings. And certainly looking at our human species as a species through the millennia, that certainly is not a trait that I can identify. So it also troubles me because I think, what went wrong with this person's relationship with those around them that they would choose to act that way? And usually, in many instances at least, it's because that person has gone through some type of trauma, neglect, or abuse, and they in turn are responding to what they experienced as trauma earlier in their lives. I think what we need to realize in dealing with those situations is to not go into judgment, and I try very hard not to, as much as it's my predisposition, like anybody is when we see something that just doesn't seem conceivable or understandable to us, but instead to try to bring compassion to that individual because of the pain that they experienced earlier in their life, regardless of how it's being manifested now. And I think that that's the underlying guiding principle that can help to, frankly, not only heal our relationships towards animals in our lives, each of us, but also our relationship with each other and the very dysfunctional relationship we have with our planet. And that is to bring awareness and compassion to how we relate to the world around us, other beings, other people, other individuals, our world, our physical world. And the way in which I feel we can do that is through greater sensitivity and awareness. We are caught up, I believe, as human beings in the modern day world, so much with our pressures and preoccupations of day-to-day life that we're ignoring important signals around us. We ignore them or dismiss them from the people around us as they're communicating with us. We focus so much on words and in email. We don't pay attention to the cues and nuances of communication that don't have a thing to do with words. The reality is we communicate, if we're in front of each other, much more so non-verbally than we do verbally. Even my talking with you, just voice-wise, I'm communicating much, much more in terms of my content through intonation and how I express myself, even where I struggle for words than just with literally the words themselves. With our how we respond and communicate and interpret each other, it becomes really important to realize that, to me, to focus on being more aware and sensitive of where the other individual is coming from. That means the people I talk to, you on the phone, the person standing across from me is I'm sitting at the train station. The dog or cat as I walk into a friend's home, or the leopard or lion or zebra at the zoo, but also being more sensitive to the what our world is sharing with us, the level of change that our world is going through as a result of our human activities right now is unprecedented with respect to climate change and habitat loss. And we tend to ignore these things and dismiss them for what seem to be more pressing, urgent, immediate needs. And what we're bringing ourselves to is a brink where it's in our situation as a species where we're not going to be able to escape those signals. And I don't think it behooves us to try to dismiss what our planet, what other people, what other beings are trying to share and tell us and communicate with us. So I think the biggest thing we can do is to try to be more sensitive and more aware that there's a lot of other ways of being and understanding and perceiving our world than we tend to just fall into in our daily patterns. And in doing so, we can bring much more compassion, empathy, and healing to our relationships, our lives, and the world around us if we were to do so.
I think that as humans, we could learn a lesson from our animal counterparts that seem to live in the moment a lot better than we do sometimes. I'm wondering, are they able to forget these horrific experiences? And what's the treatment? What are the treatment options for those animals who have been through some sort of traumatic experience?
Well, certainly. I work with animals that, because of the level of trauma that they've experienced, they have trouble getting over the pain and that they've had in their lives, and they suffer from that. The ways in which we go about healing those animals is by quite literally bringing empathy and compassion into our relationship with them. What that means is that we recognize and accept the response that they have to the world, and we give them the opportunity to choose to experience relationships that are not traumatic, and experience a world which feels safe and controllable. So how we go about how I go about trying to work with animals like that is to help them to have a world which is safe, comforting to them, provide them with what they consider to be their basic needs, but also provide them with an opportunity to have a sense of control over their world, to give them choice so that they don't have to be pushed, nudged, or forced in any direction, even a direction that we feel might be best as far as their healing, so that they have the grace and opportunity to recover as they're best able to, and also to give them time, care, attention, and love.
Well, Dr. Verga, I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed our visit this morning. Thank you so much for taking the time. I'd like to end with one final question, and that is just to ask, what's the one thing you'd like for our listeners to take away from this conversation as they consider the human-animal connection?
Well, thank you for inviting me to join you. And I feel that the most important message that I would offer anyone is really the challenge I struggle with day to day in my own life. And that what keeps me up when I wake up in the middle of the night, and what I commit to each day when I wake up in the morning, and that is how can I be more more sensitive to the world around me, to the other beings around me, both people and other animals. How can I bring how can I best make a difference in the world, and how can I leave the world around me in that day better for my having been there? And that challenge to me ultimately boils down to bringing awareness, a willingness to look at the world from a fresh new perspective each day, realizing that even those situations, those people, those animals that I find really hard to understand or cope with, trying my best to step out of my shoes and into the shoes of another, so that I can do that, so I can bring a sense of empathy and compassion and healing to my relationship with them. And with that level of commitment in our daily lives, I really believe that if we were to all walk around with that intention each day, as we were to get up each day with a renewed intention to try to understand the world from a broader perspective than we usually do, and to bring a greater sense of empathy towards others in the world, I believe that level of intention would dramatically bring healing quite literally and physically to those around us and to the physical planet. I love my dog as much as I love you.
whatever you may say, my dog will always come through. I love my dog, baby, I love my dog.